his name will pop up a couple times, but more as a prelude. And a, he was consistent with it. He was consistent with it. So.
Did he drive a horse one time and say, I think I understand you?
There may be, I don't know whether that's folklore or what. He did go insane for the last 10 years of his life or something like that before he died. So he died right in, I think it was 1900. All right, well, I think Norman's probably got the thing turned on upstairs by this point. So anyways, we'll start with prayer and go from there. Thank you, Lord, for this time together. We just thank you for the weeks that have preceded this, and we just pray that looking forward on into the future that you'll just continue to challenge us with these ideas and spur us on to thinking how we can engage the culture that is around us from a biblical perspective and help us to remain faithful to the calling you've called us to and devoted to you in all things. So commit our time to you now and be with us and teach us as you will. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, so here we are. We are going to try and work our way through the last half of the set of slides on naturalism. So I guess it would have been two of these classes ago. We started it 2 weeks ago, the middle class. We had sort of an interlude. We decided we would go with the video Human Zoos to introduce some of the practical issues that arose, especially with the birth of Darwinian evolution, as that morphed from just a biological theory into a social theory. And so you have social Darwinism, which was, you know, really the birth of the eugenics movement, and a lot of the human atrocities that happened. Just so Darwinism gave sort of a moral justification for a lot of, you know, the eugenics movement and a certain form of racism that, you know, racism had been around a long time. It's not that racism was ever just born out of that, but it gave it sort of a scientific aura. There was nothing scientific about it. We would call it pseudoscience today. But a lot of those ideas still live on. A lot of our culture, you've heard the term probably culture of death, which was spoken of quite a bit by Pope John Paul II. So abortion, euthanasia, that kind of stuff, the beginning of life, the end of life. You know, what matters is this person, this young, robust person in between who's got the smarts, they've gone off to college, to university, you know, they make lots of money, that kind of stuff. But if you're on the opposite side, if you're not really a university type person, if you're not a, you know, making it big time in the world of the economic world that of live and die, you know, you're expendable. And so this is kind of the fallout. Once you remove the biblical worldview, we talked about deism. Deism still had a very strong Christian set of values. It never removed itself from that. It thought it would continue on the Christian moral tradition without all the superfluous, you know, religious stuff attached to it. We can still believe in God. He's still sort of the foundation of our morals, but morals is still important, but we can get rid of the, you know, all the supernatural stuff, all of the, you know, all of the specific things that distinguish Christianity from Judaism, from Islam, from all these other religions. That's all superfluous. All we need to do is just believe in God. Naturalism eliminates God from the equation altogether. And then we start to see the fallout. Because you're no longer living in a world where you have the bedrock that held up society whether morally or socially and so forth. So you begin to go through these phases of tearing away the onion, as it were, the layers of the onion, to see, you know, what is the meaning in life, what is the purpose in life once you abandon God, and specifically, and more specifically, once you abandon the Christian faith, and where does that lead to? And so we're walking down that path as we keep peeling back the onion, as it were. And as we'll get talking about a little bit more as we go along today, naturalism is kind of this umbrella term for a number of, a series, as it were, of sub-worldviews, naturalistic worldviews. There are different schools of thought under this umbrella of naturalism, which is just essentially the denial of God's existence. And all it is this material world governed by a set of abstract laws, and there's nothing else beyond that. And we just happen to be a more complex admixture of atoms and so forth than other such things. So anyways, we've worked our way through worldview up to worldview question 6. That's what we're going to pick up with today. And so the question is what happens to us after we die? What is our ultimate destiny? Now, as Christians, this is an important question, and we have a very ready answer to that. We can talk about, you know, a future resurrection life. We can talk about being with God. We can talk about a new heaven and a new earth. We can talk about an ultimate destination. And a deist, that's a little bit more difficult. Some of them still believed in an immortality of the soul. They still believe that, you know, even here on this planet, we can still, you know, be good people and look forward to a judgment where, if we lived good enough lives, God will judge us approvingly. Well, the naturalist, once you remove God from that equation, you know, what is the answer to this question? And I think the answer is very obvious. What happens to us when we die? Well, death is extinction of personality and individuality. That's it. You live, you came into this world, you go out, that's it. There's nothing left. Nothing more to talk about. No afterlife, no final judgment. This life is all that there is. Now, there is a bit of an exception to this rule, and that's Friedrich Nietzsche. And we'll come to him in more detail later on down the road, but for Nietzsche, he has this theory of the theory of eternal recurrence. And this is very naturalistic. There is no God. There is no it's an utter rejection of theism. It's an utter rejection even of pantheism. But he believes, but he talks about how we live our lives over and over again in all of its details. You just keep living it over the circular, ongoing flow of repeating your life over and over again. All the decisions, all the events, everything is the same. And he thought that by acknowledging this, you know, it's depressing, but at the same time, it's our job to take, you know, be courageous and to take hold of that and affirm that, because you don't want to affirm the existence of God. You don't want to affirm anything over and above my nature. It's just me going through this process eternally, over and over again. He is the exception to this one rule. Everything's still naturalistic. Everything is still, it's still a closed system. The world is still a closed system. It's not that there's some override, there's some mind organizing things and ordering it to go through. It's not even, you know, as in form of Hinduism and stuff like that, it's not being reborn, you know, based on the life that you lived, you come back as either a higher form or a lower form of being. It's not that. Because there's no judgment based on how you lived your life. You're just going to keep living this life over and over again, and everything's going to be the same, including the way you think, act, do, everything. So it's obviously fatalistic. It's obviously, you know, in many ways depersonalizing, but he's trying to personalize it too. He's saying, you know, this is something that we ought to take hold of and affirm and you know, and just, you know, do our best to make good of the situation, as it were. But again, he's a bit of an exception. There aren't too many people who are naturalists who would take sides with Nietzsche on that. This is a little bit more typical. Next page, Bertrand Russell, in his book, Why I Am Not a Christian, he says this, that man is a product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can a soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Are those encouraging words or what? Now, notice the certainty, the near certainty. He's basically saying, if not quite beyond all these things, if not quite beyond dispute, or so nearly certain that no philosophy that rejects him can hope to stand. But he is an absolutely committed atheist. There's no question about that. And hence the title of the book, Why I'm Not a Christian. But he's just laying it out bare, the consequences that you have to accept if you accept naturalism. If you accept naturalism and there is no God, forget about immortality. Not just of your own life, of all your deeds, of all of human achievement, it's going to get wiped out. The universe itself, the solar system, will at one day be extinguished itself, as if it never ever existed. And there's nothing in the long run that can save us from having that happen to us. And it makes you reflect back on your life. So, okay. So, if all of that I've valued, if everything that we have as a human creature has valued, and that all goes for naught in the end, you know, what am I to do with that? And that's the existential question. That's where you have to decide. You're put in the position, how shall I then live? You know, what do I make of that? And those are the questions. And the thing is, it's built right into us in our human nature is like, if I don't have purpose, if that purpose is extinguished, then why should I live? Is it better to live than to not live? Those types of questions come up. And so you wonder in our own culture why it is that when you abandon the Christian faith, all of a sudden you have this, you know, this striving for different forms of thought, New Age movement, we'll try Eastern mysticism, we'll try this. They keep trying in different corners of, you know, we'll console ourselves through entertainment, we'll console ourselves through this, through that, through the other thing. But at the very back of it, they still have to answer this question, what shall I make of my life in a world if I accept these premises and the conclusions, what do I make of it, all of that? How shall I then live? Why does it matter how I live with others in community? Again, we're peeling back the onion and we're finding there's nothing there. There is no core. There is no heart of the matter. There is no There's nothing you can grasp onto and say, yes, this makes life worth living. Yeah, he doesn't believe in the soul. Because he's using it figuratively. Because that's the way we use language. Not that there's any metaphysical reality to it, but it's that my inner being, my sense of worth, my sense of who I am, that's the only thing we can safely build our... Yeah, so as you say, it's about, the words become meaningless. We use a lot of words, which our society uses a lot of words that have past meaning, which no longer holds that meaning, but we keep using it. Like, you ask an atheist, do they believe in Jesus Christ? No. They say no. Unless maybe they believe there's a historical man called Jesus, but he's not there's nothing supernatural about him whatsoever. But this person may swear the name Jesus Christ all the time, left, right, and center. Well, why do you keep using Jesus' name every time you cuss? Well, just there's no reason for it. They just do it. It's been ingrained into them through their socialization. It's your social custom. It's your customary way of doing things. So when someone like Bertrand Russell speaks about the soul's habitation, there is no reality to the notion of a soul for him. You're just a collocation of atoms. He's made that well known. So any sense of a soul is just this personal, phenomenological, inner sense of my identity. I'm an I. I'm not. I experience myself as an individual person. I don't experience myself as this collocation of atoms, obviously. So that's all he's referring to, is this phenomenological experience of my being, my inner being, my existence, my personhood. That's all it is. Yes, Donna.
Would there be any, would he think, well, at least I'm leaving my work behind so that I can help the people that live after I have died?
So Bertrand Russell, as far as posterity is concerned, was very socially active in his old age up into the 1960s. He was, this is a man who was born back in the late 1800s. He was one of the most important philosophers of the early 20th century, especially with the mathematical logic that was developed back at that early time. So he was a philosopher and one of the more significant names in analytical philosophy of the 20th century. He helped birth analytical philosophy in the West. But he was also very socially and actively involved. He was involved in war protests and stuff like that. And so, obviously for him, he decided that, well, despite all of this reality that it's all for naught, nevertheless, I am going to try and change the world for the better. And so he had a moral side to him. There's no question about that. And one of the things we've talked about is that you could be an atheist and you can still be moral. The question is what are your foundations for your morality? Once you deny God as the foundation of all morals, moral norms and so forth, it's...
Relativism.
So the issue is, who decides what's right and what's wrong if God's not the arbiter of what's right and what's wrong? Well, either you can do it yourself or you can let somebody else do it. So And there are people who think, and there are people who have come and gone, who have thought, well, they should be the arbiters of what is right and what's wrong. So that's the open question for the naturalist, is who decides? Because you can't help but be in a moral, you can't be, help as a human person as being some kind of a moral creature. You could be a completely immoral creature, but you're still a moral creature. You still have this inner sense of right, or unless you're an outright complete psychopath, you do have a sense of what is right and what's wrong. And that's and that's just the reality in which you live. I have this sight, so you have this division now between that's happening. Think in terms of, we've talked about Immanuel Kant, how he made that distinction between the realm of the phenomena, me and my experience of the world as it is in itself, versus the noumenal realm, the world as it is in itself, which I don't directly experience. So the here you are as a naturalist, is that you've basically said, well, all this stuff, this metaphysical jargon, all this religious stuff I reject now, and all I have got left is this sense of what's real, which does, it's not conducive at all to being a moral creature whatsoever. It's not conducive at all to giving purpose to my life. So now I'm left with this position. I can go one route, nihilism, and say, it is all worthless. It is all meaningless. And I just have to live this life of meaninglessness. Or you could go a different direction, the road of the existentialist or the postmodernist. I'll make up my own values. Or you could go the other route of the dictator, the tyrant, of the Marxist route, where you'll impose a good order on people top down, and you will make them live within that structure.
Or how about Buddha? He says everything is an illusion. You have to live on this higher plane or something.
Yeah. Well, we have, right now. Buddhism's a bit of a different story. We won't cover. We won't get into Buddhism today, but it may came up at some other point. But you have that a somewhat of a analogous situation there, though with Buddhism and certain forms of Hinduism and stuff like that too, where you have this perceived reality versus the real in itself. And so, the Christian faith is that what I perceive is also, it's not, we don't have this distinction between reality in itself versus the phenomenal reality of my experience as being the two not being united whatsoever. We affirm that God created this world. We affirm that God created my cognitive abilities such that I can know the world in which I live. And like we argued, that's the background. That is the very worldview basis of science. If you don't have that, you don't have modern day notion of science. So that is what, gives us confidence that we can talk about the world. And we can talk about the world both in its good qualities and its bad qualities. We can say that evil is real. For some Eastern religions, evil is not real. It's what you think you are experiencing, but in ultimate reality, there is nothing that you could identify as truly good or truly, truly evil. So, all right. So this is, we're beginning now to get into this little bit more depressing turn. You start digging away. We talked about what is prime reality. Well, prime reality is not God. Prime reality is just the physical world in which we live. Energy and mass and stuff like that, and motion, all that kind of stuff. And then knowledge. Well, the naturalist is fairly positive about, certain naturalists are positive about our ability to know the world, others are not. The question that the Christian brings to those who are very positive about our ability to know the world is, are you not just gleaning that optimism from a Christian worldview? Whereas others such as Nietzsche took that naturalistic worldview to its ultimate conclusions and didn't think, hey, we know nothing. So Naturalism, again, we're talking about foundations of knowledge and stuff like that. You start stripping God away, and all these things start falling apart. You just have no foundation. So,
can I just...
Yes.
With Nietzsche and his theory of, like, eternally occurring...
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of how he explained why so many people were theistic or you know, had a belief in God? Why would he think that was even happening within this, you know, mechanical repeating pattern? Why do so many people think that there's another reality?
Well,
Nietzsche
thought it was just an illusion. Yeah. Nietzsche's coming off the, you know, he's had his predecessors who've gone before him. Like he just assumes Darwin's right about evolution, but also the people who came before him included some thinkers who had already been proposing, like whether it's Marx or Ludwig Feuerbach, who wrote the book The Essence of Christianity, which is basically to say that God is infinitely large human being that we've dreamed up.
Right.
Basically,
but
yeah.
I'm wondering if the possibility of so many people having this illusion should at least raise the thought in his mind that he might be having the illusion.
Well,
he must be very sure that he's not. If so many
people
obviously believe he is having the illusion.
Well, that's the thing is, people who speak very confidently about what we don't know or are incapable of knowing are making very positive claims of what they think we can know. And that's always contradictory. That always leads to undermining your own thinking. So especially when we get into postmodernism and the claims of postmodernism, which Nietzsche is also at the background of, you start making claims that there are no absolute right and wrong, there is no absolute truth, but then you say, well, you just made an absolutely true claim. That there is no such thing as absolute truth. So you're caught up, it's called the argument of retortion. It's when your actions betray your own words. So you get yourself caught up in an act of contradiction. But Nietzsche is actually pretty good at catching all of this, but I think Nietzsche is more of the kind, he takes the starting point that God is dead. That's his starting point. That's the assumption. It's a presupposition. What interests Nietzsche is not, can we prove that God's dead, or can we prove that God doesn't exist? He's not interested in that at all. He just assumes, cultures determine that. We've determined that. Darwinism's taken care of that. I don't need to deal with that. His question simply is, okay, now that we've affirmed that God is dead, how shall we then live? That's what he's interested in. Not in the question of arguing apologetically for God's non-existence. He's kind of leaving that to others, and he's just assuming that they've already crossed that bridge to the point of no return. With the type of confidence that you already hear in Bertrand Russell, these other philosophies, too bad for them, they're just wrong. We pretty much have near certainty that God just doesn't. So forget about it. Let's move on to the next slide, worldview question number 7. What is the meaning of human history? I guess we've kind of been broaching this one already. History is a linear stream of events linked to the cause and effect without an overarching purpose. Human history and the history of the universe are one and the same history. All events are causally linked in a single, naturally unfolding material process. This is the type of answer that someone like Bertrand Russell would give you. This is the type of answer that someone, Richard Dawkins, for example, would give you. You know, this is kind of what you hear from the naturalistic scientific community. And probably... Now, someone like Nietzsche is obviously not quite, like, cause and effect, yes, he's good with that. Linear system, well, he's kind of caught up in a circular system, actually. the doctrine of eternal recurrence is not exactly a linear system. There's linearity in your lifetime, but if you keep living that over and over again, it's a bit of a circular thing. So he's a bit of an exception, I guess you could say, to that. But if history is closed, if there is no ordering rational, you know, mind behind all of this, then history is just one step after another, cause, effect, cause, effect, cause, effect, until it all runs out and the universe is no more. But there have been a number of, that's going from sort of the idea of, you know, what is history theoretically, you know, or what is history? It's a linear series of cause and effects. It has a beginning, it has an end. But there are different, what we would call, theories of history, the meaning part of history, meaningful part of history. And there are naturalists who have given different ways of thinking about it. And in fact, in that, when you go back to the 1800s, you get this birth with people like Hegel, among others, that history goes through a type of evolution, where you go from more primitive to more advanced. Now, we saw something of that with deism. With deism, you had sort of a theory of history, which is that you go from more primitive to advanced as we begin to discover, you know, through the methods of science, we can increase our technological capacities, and we can reach a higher levels of, you know, closing in on what we might consider human utopia, the human utopian dream. We're all free. We're no longer in shackles anymore. We're no longer enslaved to nature or to kings or tyrants and so forth. We're perfectly free to live as rational creatures. Well, naturalism, once it comes onto the scene, it begins to have its own sort of way of looking at history and interpreting history. One of those persons is Auguste Comte. Now, anybody here heard of Auguste Comte? Yeah, Ivan, you have, but most of you have not. So his name isn't bandied about today like people like, Darwin or Marx, Karl Marx, or Freud, or people like that, who are very notable figures. But he had a lot of influence. He was a positivist philosopher, and when I say positivist, we've talked about that before. Positivism is basically a school of thought where everything's based on observation. If you cannot ground something in observation, you must set it aside as nonsensical. So, you know, to talk about a human soul, you can't verify that through the means of science, so it must not. We just can't affirm its existence, or we can just safely set it aside, say it's just nonsensical, meaningless gibberish, or it just doesn't exist. Same with God, you know, same with immortality, the whole notion of immortality. It's not something that science can verify, so therefore we can't affirm it. So he's actually known as the father of positivism. But he also had this interesting theory of history, which was quite influential, in that history goes through three different stages. The first stage is what he calls the theological stage, that in searching for ultimate it's a theological stage in which we're searching for ultimate explanatory causes in the world. The anomalies of experience are attributed to supernatural beings. So earthquakes, stuff like that, storms. You think of ancient worlds. You can see how polytheism. You have this god of thunder. You have the god of the sea. You have the god of, you know, over agriculture, or over the god over, you know, over giving birth and stuff like that. You have all these gods which are kind of territorial. They're responsible for certain aspects of the life in which you experience, and you realize you just have no control over any of this, and so you offer sacrifice to appease the gods. You haven't had a child. You find out who the god is who's responsible for allowing you to become fertile, and then you pray to that god and you offer sacrifices and so forth. So this is what Comte has in mind. So for those parts of life where you just realize you don't have control over and so forth, you credit that to some type of God. He calls that the theological stage. The second stage is what he calls the metaphysical stage. In search for explanatory causes, supernatural explanations are replaced by abstract entities. So here you might think of Plato talking about, you know, what is it that animates bodies? Well, we posit a soul as something which animates bodies. Or why does things have such of a structure? Well, we posit a form, an idea, as an archetype upon which, you know, this corporeal body comes together in such a way. So we're thinking about Plato, Aristotle, people like that who posit metaphysical entities, whether it's forms or souls and so forth, as explanatory reasons for why things are the way they are, why they act the way they act. So you're moving out the gods as being responsible for this or that, and you have metaphysical explanations for it. But the third stage, you move up to the positive stage. Man quits looking for causes and looks instead for laws that govern causal events. That is, natural explanations discovered by science. And this is where Comte in his own day would say, this is where society has led us to, that we have progressed through the stages of ignorance up to where we actually know what's going on because of the dictates of science. And so we have progressed through these different stages, and now we are advanced, now we are civilized, now we are people who can take control of our own lives, and we now know the laws of nature. We can utilize that, you know, for our own technological purposes and so forth. You can now govern society based on our knowledge of natural laws about human action and activities. So he was a sociologist, one of the founders of sociology, the school of sociology. Social laws, laws that govern the way we structure things and so forth. Well, that was one. That's one proposal. Another proposal is Marxism. Marxism proposed a type of dialectical materialism, which manifests itself over time in history. So all things are determined material progress from feudalism to capitalism to utopian socialism or communism. So we go through this stage of different types of economic orders. You go back to the Middle Ages, you have feudalism, which is basically where you have a lord who owns all the land, and you have a bunch of serfs who works under you, essentially as slaves to work the land and so forth, but you basically give them a house to live in, you give them food and shelter and clothing, but they have this very meager lifestyle. They own nothing. The feudal lord owns everything. But then you go through an advance. You advance from that feudal order into a capitalist order, where all of a sudden now you have more people taking ownership. We call them the bourgeoisie. They are the ones who owns the means to production. They're the ones who are the factory owners. They are the ones who have all the technology for making things. And then they have these people they employ, the proletariat. The proletariat own nothing as far as the means of production is concerned. They may own a house and so forth, but they do not own. They get this meager pay that helps them get by from day to day, from week to week, but just enough to survive. While the bourgeoisie, the people who own all the capital, they're the ones, you know, exploiting the workers. They take in all the money. They enrich themselves. They become the elites, and they order society according to their own plans and desires, which basically is to keep themselves in power over the proletariat. And then Marxism says, okay, so this is happening through a process which we have no control over. You go from serfdom essentially to capitalism, but then capitalism has within it its own fissures, its own weaknesses, which then leads to the birth of communism. And communism is where nobody owns anything and everybody's completely equal. There is no bourgeoisie, there is no proletariat, there's just you. Completely you in this utopian society. There's a step that has to happen for that to occur, and that is you have to set up this bureaucracy, this communist bureaucracy, which is totalitarian, which then brings you from that capitalist to the communist state, of utopian state, but that's just intermediate. That's just, you know, short term. But this is happening out of our control. It's a materialistic process. It's the working out of history itself. Dialectical materialism. All of these previous forms of social order have within them the seeds of their own destruction. They then begin to become and morph into something else. So it's kind of evolution applied to history at the economic level. And so you have a beginning point where you have very few people that have all the power and everybody else is exploited, and then you work your way down through history to the point where everybody's completely egalitarian society. Nobody has any control over it. Everything's completely egalitarian. There are no rich, there are no poor. We're just all equally poor. Yes, Mark. So, as we will, when we get to Marxism, which will, I believe, be the next set of lectures, will be on Marxism. We'll be talking about that, how Marxism, no matter how many there are different, so, and within Marxism, you have different schools of thought battling it out against each other, and they keep saying, well, Lenin had the right idea, but then Stalin completely destroyed all that, completely got away from Marx. Then there's others who say, well, Lenin didn't get Marx right. And so forth. So you have all these excuses. You have all of these Marxist regimes down through the 20th century and into the 21st century, all implementing various forms of Marxism. And they're all a colossal failure at a humanitarian level. So when we'll have to talk about it, because it's the reality, and nobody talks about it publicly, but for as bad as Hitler was in killing 6 million people, he came nowhere close to Stalin and Mao. Nowhere close. When we're talking Stalin and Mao, we're talking tens of millions of people. Mao, there are always disputes over the numbers. Mao is probably the greatest mass murderer in history, and we're talking probably at least 50 million people who suffered their end under his regime. Yeah. And usually their common tactic is to starve people to death until they submit. So, and this is... And because Marxism is such a powerful cultural influence, and National Socialism is not, you're not going to hear the bad side of Marxism in the schools and so forth, as we should know the history. Like, just like we talked about how we don't know this, most of you had never heard of eugenics before. That's part of our history. It was real. You know, people were affected by that greatly. And we look at that and say, how could people have believed that? Well, nobody teaches about, you know, that's what people believed so many years ago. And nobody wants to go back and admit that we did that. It's the same thing. A Marxist will only, they may look and not very be very happy with Stalin, but they'll say, well, it's not Marx's fault that Stalin did what he did. Stalin just went off key entirely. So they have their excuses. Mao, on the other hand, is really popular within some university systems and so forth. So keep an eye on him. So anyways, that's Marxism. So we get this dialectical materialism. We'll get into that kind of stuff more deeply when we get into January. Friedrich Nietzsche, we've already talked about his theory of eternal recurrence. History repeats itself. We relive our lives over and over again in all of its details. Nothing new occurs from one life to the next. Emphasis on theory. There's no escapism from this world. For example, no Christian immortality in the world to come. This world is all that is. There's no creative designer in control over history, moving it to a final end. The truly authentic person will embrace this world as is with courage. That's Nietzsche. And finally, social Darwinism, which we've talked about. History is one of an open-ended evolutionary progress within which humans, using the methods of science, are able to take control over their own evolution by eliminating the weak and feeble-minded and proliferating the strong and the acute, mentally acute. So you have these schools of thought. This is where they're finding their meaning without God. Yeah, sure, Ivan.
Why did they feel that their assessment of who was worthy to live, how did they feel that that differed from what they criticized, say, the medieval church of killing the heretics, you know, deciding that they're not fit to live? How did they know that their vision of who was a worthy individual under eugenics was valid?
Yeah. So the question is why is it that they could justify essentially their atrocities?
Yeah.
The eugenists justify the atrocities, whereas they can go back and criticize the medievalists. Well, it's because they thought they knew stuff that the medievalists didn't, were ignorant about.
Right.
They thought they had real knowledge.
Like medical.
Their optimism about science is what. This is the Enlightenment. This is the ongoing influence of the Enlightenment that, which Darwinism was just building off of. It's this that we know it. You know, we know our history now. We know that to think theologically is to think backwards. To think scientifically is to think forwards. And we can analyze a person's cranium. And we can judge based on, you know, the configure of their cranium, whether they're feeble-minded or whether they're advanced, whether they're closer to the apes or whether they're closer to, you know, this ideal type of white Nordic.
So
measuring their nose, measuring their foreheads,
yeah,
and stuff like that, taking calipers to people's heads and stuff like that, and that to them was sufficient knowledge. Of course, early 20th century, they didn't know anything about genetics. There was a lot of stuff they did not know, and this is why this is where you have to put things that claims that get made by science today into its proper context. So things like climate alarmism, we have the science. The science is fixed. We know it. Well, these people were making the same claim back then. We know the science. This is what the science says. But the thing is they didn't know the science. They didn't know the genetics, human genetics at the time. In the same way, you know, we can't forecast the weather a week from today, let alone what it's going to be like 50 years from now. You cannot put into a computer model all of the contingencies of all the different data that you need to know whether this pattern of events ever going to unfold or not. It's too complex. The data is too complex. And because of that, any claim that gets made within the science field, if it is truly scientific, will always be tentative. Always be ready to be overridden by the next the next hypothesis, which has better verifiable, you know, observations.
Objectively.
Objectively.
Then it's a hypothesis or a theory, but these people think it's fact.
It's supposed to be fact. And that's the thing, is that it is a misjudgment. And this is one of the warnings that we've been talking about. This was the warnings against the Enlightenment we talked about with respect to the Enlightenment. The Christian faith from a biblical worldview says we can know the world. God has given us cognitive capacities. However, two things. We're finite. And secondly, we have a problem called sin. And those two things combined humble our opinions and our claims to knowledge. And this is where we need God's revelation to come through and speak to us, because we easily get off track. And the problem with is you get a worldview with a set of presuppositions that make false claims about reality. Remember, a worldview is a set of presuppositions which you assume about reality. You start off with the wrong assumptions. The conclusions may not just be wrong, they may be horrifyingly wrong. So that's what you have to, that's where the Christian worldview tapers can, should be, you know, a tapering, moderating influence upon culture, is that our claim, including science, is that our claims about the world always have to be held with this recognition that we could be wrong. But anyways, we still live in the age in which postmodernism is a moderating influence on Enlightenment modernism with respect to knowledge, the claims to knowledge. But in the meantime, postmodernism is making its own absolute claims, which are in many cases wrong, dead wrong. So, question 8.
Should we
pause for some qualifications and then come back? Oh yes, let's do a break. Let's take a 5-minute break and then grab your goodies and we'll come back.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm mic'd up and ready to go, so I'm assuming that things are recording upstairs too. So question number 8. The question is what personal life-changing core commitments are consistent with this worldview? And so like we talked about is that you're set in, you accept naturalism, you're in this spot where you still have to make a decision about how I'm going to live, what I'm going to do with my life. You know, there's a sense where I still have, even if it contradicts your philosophy and you deny that you have agency, there's a certain sense in which I still have to live. And I have to act as if I were an agent, even if I'm not an agent. So what personal life-changing core commitments are consistent with this worldview? Well, naturalism itself implies no particular core commitment on the part of any given naturalist. Rather, core commitments are adopted unwittingly or chosen by individuals. There is no answer. It provides no answer. There is no telos. There's no goal. There's no final cause. You kind of have to make that up for yourself. That's all you're left with. And really, all we can talk about here, as far as core commitments go, there are influential schools of thought within the large umbrella of naturalism. So we've talked a number of weeks ago about secular humanism, and we can also talk about humanitarianism, which places a lot of emphasis on compassion towards all human beings. That's secular humanism is this emphasis. We talked about the three humanist manifestos, where we have to show, where the goal is to show compassion towards one another. They still value humans as humans. The question for them, of course, is why, but they assume that. Humanitarianism puts that compassion towards all. And so there's this emphasis upon the progress of the human species. You know, better living conditions, intellectual enlightenment, you know, all human persons around the globe, you know, becoming, you know, civilized and so forth. So secular humanism takes the commitment to human flourishing, but without any commitment to God. And we've read about the three human, in the first human manifesto we talked about from 1933, humanism is actually seen as an atheistic religious movement. The two later manifestos don't put it in those terms. It recognizes that there are, the second manifesto recognizes that there are, you know, atheistic religious humanists, but that's about it. As far as they're, so they're toning down that language, but still, it has the aura of a religion. That we can't just live our lives as these individual atom type creatures isolated from one another without any due respect, you know, justice and compassion towards one another. It seems that you just have to live that way. Now the question, of course, is as a biblically centered Christian, is like, we have to ask that question to them, is what's your basis for this? Why? Is this just a subjective opinion? Or is it objectively grounded that we ought to live this way? Humanitarianism. Humanitarianism actually started out, it was coined by Auguste Comte, who we've talked about, and it was actually intended to be a religion of humanity, a secular religion of humanity. So humanitarianism was seen by Comte as the religion of humanity. Humans ought to be the object of our devotion, not God or gods. He had this title called the Great Being, Le Grand Être, that is the object of worship, and that object of worship is humanity. Not this human or that human, but humanity, all humans. Humanity must be loved, known, and served. There was actually the establishment of a positivist humanitarian church, which worshipped humanity. Frederick Copleston, in his History of Philosophy, notes this. And Comte works out a religious system based on Catholicism in which he was brought up. Positivism will have its saints, the great benefactors of humankind, its temples, its statues, its commination, its denunciation of the principle of the enemies of mankind, its commemoration of the dead, its social sacraments, and so on. He basically stripped Catholicism of all of the supernatural, made humanity the God of worship, and you still have the saints, you have all of the sacraments, you have the sacraments and all that kind of stuff, but it's a completely human-based religion. So humanitarianism was actually, which you will oftentimes hear the term used, humanitarian and humanitarianism, was actually intended by Comte to be a religious movement, a secular religious movement. So again, this is the whole question about, of what life-changing core commitments are you going to have? Well, Comte says we ought to love humanity, be compassionate towards it, become the object, in fact, of our worship and devote ourselves to it. Now, there were certainly people in his own day who thought he was cuckoo. and perhaps narcissistic too, but when we talk about humanitarianism today, just realize when you go back to its original meaning and so forth and its original thinking, the real original thought behind it, it had a very religious meaning behind it as well. Other alternatives. We've talked a little bit about Marxism, and we can also talk today about neo-Marxism, which is a commitment to the goal of a classless communist society. For many neo-Marxists, active participation in bringing about this goal, provides meaning and purpose akin to Christian commitment to the Great Commission and bringing people to faith in Jesus Christ. You will find a whole lot of very passionate Marxists and communists out there who are as committed to their cause as the Christian is to his or her cause of the Great Commission. It is with the same religious zeal that you find. Marxism is just as eschatological as Christianity is. It's just a Christian eschatology. Rather than union with God, it's union with one another in an egalitarian society. They just replace the Christian eschatology with their own secular materialist eschatology. Marxism is very religious. George Lukács, who is one of the most important figures within 20th century neo-Marxism, so a way of rethinking Marxism, because Marxism didn't quite work out the way Marx thought it would. Karl Marx thought that you would reach this point at which the proletariat would just become, they'd realize their situation, they would start to unite and band together against the bourgeoisie in a revolution which would overcome capitalist society. Well, by the early 20th century, it's becoming very evident that that revolution wasn't happening. The proletariat seemed to be quite okay in their position. And in fact, the only places where you have these revolutions happening are places like Russia, which never was capitalist to begin with. And the only people who seem to have some type of religious fervor about Marxism were the elites, the bourgeoisie. So you have people like Lukács and amongst others, the Frankfurt School, Gramsci, well, maybe not so much Gramsci, but all of these people are elites, they're bourgeoisie, they're wealthy people. And they start having to rethink Marx and saying, well, you know what? Maybe we have the role of convincing the proletariat that they need to rebel against the evil capitalists. And so they start waiting, rather than waiting for Marx's historical dialectical materialism to fatally, to determine everything and just bring communist society into again, they need to take an active role in bringing communist society into reality. So here's a quote from it's actually, I believe it's Georg Lukács. Communist ethics makes it the highest duty to accept the necessity to act wickedly. This is the greatest sacrifice the revolution asks from us, as quoted by Roger Scruton in his book, Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands. So in other words, the ends justifies the means. You can recognize evil as evil, but the fact of the matter is the revolution is all important. Antonio Gramsci, another very important figure, he's an Italian who was a communist, who was a leader of influential in the Communist Party in Italy around the just during the period of the 1930s or so. He was imprisoned under Adolf Hitler's regime and wrote a bunch of prison notes. Some of his notes come out where he talks about this notion of hegemony, where he talks about the war of position versus the war of maneuver. So what are we talking about here? War of position is the long-term goal of building a communist society by a more subtle strategy of transforming culture by means of creating a new proletarian culture that provides an alternative to the cultural hegemony of the bourgeois society, that is the status quo. The end result will set the stage for a war of maneuver in which the proletariat, with a full sense of their class consciousness and a revolutionary mindset, will directly set out, via open revolution, to overthrow the bourgeois cultural and political control over society and thus usher in a communist society. What he's proposing here is a twofold strategy. The first strategy, the war of position, go out there, take control of culture. You know, go into the universities, take over the universities, get into the media, take over the media, get into politics, take over the politics, and become such an influence that you then, from that position of power, begin to change the culture. And in changing the culture, you change the mindset of the proletariat, where they begin to realize that they're the ones who are being adversely affected by the people, by the elites who are in power, and they will then become revolutionary in their zeal, and they will then rise up against the elites, overtake the elites, and then you have your communist utopia. So here you have in the neo-Marxist movement, with people like Gramsci and Lukács and the Frankfurt School people, who could also talk about this recognition that we need to take an active role to bring about what Karl Marx, the great prophet Karl Marx prophesied would happen. We will no longer depend upon, the dialectics of history to do that. These forces we have no control over, will take an active role and we will take over culture itself. And now you begin to wonder why culture has changed so much. Because these thinkers have already begun, they did their work and they did it well. There's a neo-Marxist slogan that's quite popular. You may have heard of it before, stated by a guy named Rudy Dutschke. I think that's how you pronounce his name. He was basically a young college student from the 1960s, very strongly committed Marxist. He says this. He talks about the long march through the institutions. That is to say, the communist long march through the institutions here in the West. In other words, you don't look for a short-term goal, you look long-term. You gradually take over the cultural institutions of society. And once you transform them, and they start spinning out a bunch of revolutionary Marxists, then eventually you'll come to a point where you can have your Marxist revolution. So what we're talking about here is What are the life-changing core commitments that are consistent with the worldview? Well, almost anything you believe is going to be consistent. In a certain sense, it will be consistent with a naturalistic worldview, because a naturalistic worldview doesn't have any final cause. It doesn't have any telos or goal other than what you make it. Marxism has a very definite final goal. It has a telos, and it's very committed to its Marxist naturalist materialist presuppositions. Here's a quote in our, I believe it's the next page 41. This is from Herbert Marcuse. a major figure in the neo-Marxist movement in the especially in the 1960s and 1970s from the Frankfurt School. He says this from his book Counter-Revolution and Revolt, written in 1972. To extend the base of the student movement, Rudi Dutschke has proposed a strategy for the long march through the institutions, working against the established institutions while working within them, but not simply by boring from within, rather by doing the job, learning how to program and read computers, how to teach at all levels of education, how to use mass media, how to organize production, how to recognize and eschew planned obsolescence, how to design, etc., and at the same time preserving one's own consciousness and working with others. The Long March includes a concerted effort to build up counter-institutions. They have long been an aim of the movement, but the lack of funds was greatly responsible for their weakness and their inferior quality. They must be made competitive. This is especially important for the development of radical free media. The fact that the radical left has no equal access to the great chains of information and indoctrination is largely responsible for its isolation. That's a lot of words, but he's essentially saying, you know, we need to take over the institutions. Everywhere, all spheres, all levels, it doesn't matter where. Not just politics, but we're talking culture, we're talking the schools, we're talking the churches, everywhere. And he's saying back in the 1970s, so far we haven't been well funded. Well, that has changed today. They are very well funded. So if you wonder what's going on in the universities today, I'll guarantee you, like in the United States, Columbus University, in I believe it's New York, is the very hub of the Frankfurt School of neo-Marxism. So the neo-Marxists came over from Germany during the Second World War because Hitler was in power, and there was a, needless to say, a great tension between the communists and Marxists on the one hand and the National Socialists on the other. So they came and escaped to the United States, and they set up shop, basically, in the universities and so forth. So Herbert Marcuse stayed in the United States. Others, like Theodor Adorno, eventually went back to Germany. But they stayed in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s owes, you know, the hippie movement and stuff like that owes an awful lot to people like Herbert Marcuse. So we also have Nietzscheism and existentialism. In and of them, of themselves, our lives have no meaning other than what meaning we make for ourselves. To be authentically human is to choose for ourselves our own values and make of our lives what we want to become, not what anybody else says. The future is completely open to us to make ourselves whatever we will. The famous existential slogan is, "Existence precedes essence." In other words, we do not have a fixed determinate essence or human nature. What defines us is which defines us of who we are. We define who we are by the choices that we make during the course of our lifetimes. You will determine for yourself by the choices that you make who you are. You have no predetermined essence, no predetermined human nature that defines who you are. You make the choice yourself.
How would they explain, Dr. Ron, people who have chosen to believe in God, follow his plan, or as well as they understand it, as revealed in the scriptures? Is that valid for them? Can people choose to follow God, or is that just
So basically the question is, you know, with all their emphasis upon freedom to choose, going to make of ourselves whatever we want to be, how is that consistent with, you know, choosing to be a believer in Jesus Christ? Well, on the surface of it, it shouldn't be controversial. If you have the freedom to choose, you have the freedom to choose. However, for someone like Sartre, his starting point is atheistic. He takes the Dostoevsky quote that God is dead. If God is dead, then, you know, anything goes. And Sartre basically says, that's right. God, if God is dead, then anything goes, and we can determine for ourselves how we ought to live. So Sartre, kind of like Nietzsche, doesn't argue for God's non-existence. He's committed to the fact that God just doesn't exist, and this is now how we ought to live, in light of the fact that God does not exist. Now, there is a Christian form of existentialism, which is not to be confused with the atheistic version. So you've probably heard of, some of you may have heard of Soren Kierkegaard. So Kierkegaard is sort of the father of existentialism, and he was a Christian. He was a Lutheran, living back in the 1800s. And there are Christian, there are significant names in, amongst Christian existentialists on into the 20th century and today. So that's still a, you know, in many ways, that's still a very viable school within the Christian thought. However, when you take the naturalistic form of existentialism versus the Christian form of existentialism, then you're left with, I just need to make choices, and I'm left on my own. Once you've committed yourself to Christianity, you may be an existentialist, but you're no longer a naturalistic existentialist or an atheistic existentialist. I don't think so. I never got the feeling that people like Sartre and that were, you know, ultimately derogatory towards Christianity. They didn't obviously believe it, but I think they're probably, in general, probably a little less antagonistic compared to, you know, the new atheists that we've seen over the past 20 years. Now, Nietzsche, on the other hand, was extremely anti-Christian. But you could not be more anti-Christian than Nietzsche. Like, derogatory, one of his last writings is called The Anti-Christian. And it's just sheer hatred towards the Christian faith. Like, he hated the New Testament. He was okay with the Old Testament, but he hated the New Testament. Nietzsche was definitely sort of the, if you want to, you know, point out some of the most antagonistic atheists in world history, you can point to Friedrich Nietzsche. He's
But was it because he viewed them as weak?
He basically saw Christians as, you know, weak, very weak, rather than strong. He looked back more to the ancient Greeks, the warrior Greeks, not so much the Platos and the Aristotles, but the warrior, Greeks who would, you know, go out and triumph in war and stuff like that. He saw that as that courage and stuff like that. That's what we need today. You know, be the overman, you know. But for him, it was like, don't ever succumb to the, you know, don't ever let anyone tell you what to believe. You determine that for yourself. You be the superman, the overman. Yeah. More on Nietzsche to come. So. And I believe we have some couple pages of concluding reflections. And then we'll open up for any questions, closing questions, and then we will close. There is not one single school called naturalism, which we've talked about. Arguably, there are several schools of thought within naturalism that are worldviews within an overriding worldview that is defined around rejection of belief in God. Hard to use them today. And these are ones which we will talk about in weeks to come, so I've given you a bit of a foretaste of what we will be talking about. Marxism, nihilism or nihilism, existentialism and postmodernism. Just add a New Age movement in there, but because of its influence from the East and the more spiritual element, it's not really a naturalistic religion. But here are some of the very key figures that you probably should know. Charles Darwin, you all know. Father of modern-day evolutionary theory. Karl Marx, the father of Marxist and neo-Marxist and communist thought. Friedrich Nietzsche, the father of nihilism, existentialism, and postmodernism. Sigmund Freud, the father of depth psychology and a key figure in the sexual revolution. The Frankfurt School, neo-Marxist school that advanced critical theory. So you may have heard of critical race theory. Critical race theory is just an extension of what's called critical theory, which was born out of the Frankfurt Marxist school. Key critical theory thinkers, Theodor Adorno, Herbert Marcuse, Jürgen Habermas, Max Horkheimer, and Eric Fromm, among others. These are just some of the more prominent names. And of course, who I also mentioned, Antonio Gramsci, who's the Italian neo-Marxist who theorized the need for Marxism to gradually take over cultural institutions in order to eventually take political control over society. And that there is a foretaste of what is yet to come. So any final questions or thoughts that you would like to raise? Yes, Donna. I don't think they're planning anything of the sort. I think that's what's happening is you're talking so mass immigration.
Yeah.
A lot of apparently there are a lot. I've been seeing reports that a lot of new immigrants to Canada are actually leaving Canada because the economy's so crappy, and they're having a hard time getting a foothold. They just want to come and probably have a. They get the notion that the West is wealthy. You can come to the West and build a home and, you know, you could live a good life in the West, whereas maybe they don't have those opportunities back home. Mass immigration is a platform within a neoliberal worldview. So neoliberal being a form of, you know, a political way of thinking, which, you know, it's a rejection of classical liberalism, which was, you know, Thomas Jefferson, Church, you know, the early American fathers, you know, freedom was, liberty was the key thing. Neoliberalism became skeptical over capitalism and adopted certain parts of socialism into it. So it's kind of a mixed capitalism, socialist type of a system. And but one of its goals is it's globalist in intent rather than nationalist. Which is to say, it has no concern. It has not the least bit of concern about local cultures. It looks globally. It looks more utopian. And there's elements of the Marxist vision in here, too. But they still hold on to a type of this welding together, this melding together of corporate capitalism and politics. Classical liberalism never held those two together. They were to be kept separate from each other. But you have neoliberalism is more of a bureaucratic. It looks towards getting past boundaries, national boundaries, and looking globally. Restructuring the world globally in a way that brings about, as they perceive it, the good of the whole. All humanity. So it's this humanitarian thing going on here, too. And you do that through establishing international institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, you know, World Human Rights, United Nations, all of these institutions, the World Health Organization, all of those are there, born out of a neoliberal mindset. So it's to propagate an order that is more or less global in intent, global in extension, and you have this coalition of corporate elites together with political elites sort of taking control of how that looks and building out from there. So the Davos conference, the G20, all that kind of stuff, that's where you get a bunch of elites coming together to sort of scheme how they're at an international level, they're going to order things. Now, when you have that globalist mindset, borders don't mean anything. Borders are an obstacle. National boundaries are an obstacle. And in order to bring about this humanitarian identity, this global identity, that will mean that you have to change people's mindset at a cultural level. And one way of doing that is you strip them of their cultural identity by mixing cultures together. So you no longer become, you can no longer form a cultural identity any longer. You're stripped of that, you're bereft of that. All you have in common is political rather than cultural. And so that's why you see so much tension going on at a political level between the nationalist Donald Trump versus the globalist Joe Biden, or what, you can take that to any country in the West, in Europe, and here in Canada. And basically what you're looking at is a battle between people who look to, you know, the conservative ideal of local culture, local business, buying locally, you know, versus the Amazons buying from these corporate entities, which are, they're not just in Canada, they're not just in Belleville, they're everywhere around the world, the McDonald's and so forth. So it's a complex, very complex topic, but so when you talk about the whole immigration influx, a lot of that is intended towards a more globalist. If your goal is globalism, then again, national boundaries and local cultures mean nothing. They're problems to be taken care of, to be abolished so you can attain this globalist identity. So whatever your goal is, the means to the end, you know, you have to, you know, so much for borders. So you get, you know, the European Union is a good example of that. Europe was a bunch of countries. The European Union basically was intentionally at the beginning simply to be this trading relationship between partners within countries of Europe. But then it has morphed over the years into this bureaucracy, bureaucratic control, where all of a sudden people in Belgium and stuff like that, these bureaucrats are making laws for people in, you know, all these different countries without the people having any say in them. Well, the European Union becomes the model for Africa, AFRICOM. It becomes the model for people who have talked about this North American Union. So you basically divide the world up into continents where they have their own union within themselves. And then over and above that, you have this overriding bureaucracy which orders that all together. And so when we talk, you've probably heard about things about Canada and the United States and countries around the world sort of sacrificing their medical autonomy to the World Health Organization in light of the recent COVID pandemic. Handing over their rights so that the World Health Organization makes decisions for the countries rather than the countries themselves having that right to make that decision for themselves. So that's globalism, and that's a neoliberal way of thinking. If that makes sense.
Kind of explains, like, I thought it was crazy for Europe. It's funny enough, it's Europe and any Western country to have this huge amount of migration, immigrants, whether they're war-torn or not, and, like, unusual numbers, like even hearing the numbers of people crossing the Mexican border into the States, it's tens of thousands a day.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at that and I say, are you people crazy? I don't care if they're left or right. But even in Canada, we have about 1 million new people this year. And how can our infrastructure support that type of thinking?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, there are all sorts of questions that get raised when you have mass immigration, a lot of it's, in the case of the United States, it's illegal immigration, not just legal immigration, illegal immigration. And that's where you have even states like New York, amongst others, which considered itself to be, you know, a sanctuary state, which means that, yeah, we're accepting of the illegals, bring them in, we'll take care of them. But now you have a mayor who's saying, we have no more space, we don't have the resources. Didn't take them too long to figure that one out, but you can imagine what the southern states are dealing with on an every, you know, Texas and Arizona, who are the border kind of states.
It's too crazy to say it's stupid. I think it's intentional. And if they're intentionally trying to overtake people from wide ranges of different cultures, different religions, ethnicities, and then just go poured in by the tons.
So just remember that neoliberalism is in no way, it's a secular world. It's a secular political perspective. Christianity means nothing to them. From the perspective, most of these people are not people of faith at all. A lot of them are. Some of them might be. I'm not saying they are or they aren't. But the thing is that within some countries, which may be predominantly Christian or it may be predominantly Muslim or something like that, they probably want to protect the faith of its people. A neoliberal has no interest at all in protecting any faith from anything. If anything, what they would look forward to is some type of universal religion that everybody agrees on and that unites everybody together. So comps humanitarian religion, that kind of stuff would be more attractive to them, much more attractive. You strip the religion of its, you know, think of the deism, strip the religion of all its supernatural stuff, strip the religion of all its peculiarities, and then you try to come up with this kernel of stuff that everybody sort of agrees upon, and it becomes it allows for some type of object of devotion and commitment. There's a realization that the Marxists, the atheists, have, as we've gone through this study, this realization that you need a religious motivating factor. If you want people to order themselves towards an end, whatever that end is, there has to be almost a religious commitment to it. And that's part of what we're fighting in society right now, is that where does your devotion lie? Now, Christianity gets attacked in the media largely because, from a more conservative viewpoint, because its commitment is not to this world. It's committed to God's kingdom, which is not of this world. And that just does not correspond with their own goals. So that's why you'll find, you may find certain figures within the religious sphere who get pulled into this neoliberal worldview about how to order society, but they've probably already abandoned their Christian worldview to begin with. When it comes to uniting all religions, technically that's not ecumenism. That's just kind of, because ecumenism is technically more of interreligious, you know, interreligion, intra-Christian, not intra-religious discussion. But you could sort of abstract the same idea, similar idea, but in order for that type of ecumenism to work across world religions, you have to do a lot of stripping down of those world religions in order to come up with some type of agreed upon. Yeah, there are a lot of key figures within Christianity and outside of Christianity, within other religions that are very committed to this type of ideal. And that's part of what we're up against. And this isn't just, you know, just Marxism. This isn't just existential. This is a political thing that's happening. And it's a little bit hard to define if you could call it a worldview or not. It's bordering on that at this point.
I just see where you've got Satan working with the world, but now he's also in the church and religion to bring about his ultimate goal.
Yeah, exactly.
The only solution is to go back to old order Mennonitism. That'll weed out those who want to drive cars.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's something to be said when you think and you sit down, you think about the process. Like Paul's thing in Ephesians, our war is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers of this world. And also realize that a lot of the system in which we live is in many ways beholden to the principalities and powers of this world. And so the question is, for us as a Christian, and this is a complex one, this is when I get in discussion with sometimes at work, is how do we become, you know, participants in this world without becoming the world? And that's probably a bigger challenge, to be quite frank, today than it was even in Paul's time.
I'm looking at from the history from Constantine on, and I see the slow type of contamination in the churches throughout history. But now it's so... Today, I don't know what real Christianity is in these Christian organizations. And that's what I... Like, where do you go for Christianity anymore? Like, a true Christian? You can't go across the street. You can't, name an institution. They're all contaminated by the same. I came from one that was contaminated plus. Mm-hmm. That's the United Church.
Well, I think we do have some pointers. And we've been talking about that. What is a biblical worldview? And so we are committed to a biblical worldview. And there are points at which we recognize there are certain ideas that are just completely anti-biblical, where you just can't read the Bible in light of this worldview and say they agree with each other. They just do not. Without saying that this part of the Bible is irrelevant, it's culturally past, it's prime or whatever. You begin to pick up on that, and once you get to the point where the Bible is seen as something archaic and irrelevant, and Jesus Christ, start hearing the language, Jesus isn't the only way, the only truth, and the only source
exactly
to life.
Then,
once you start hearing that language, that's a pretty good sign that what you're hearing is outside of Christianity. So I think that's where we try to be biblically minded as much as we can. And I think one of the things that I've been, pressed myself on is trying to understand the Bible on its own terms. So to understand the Bible on its own terms means to understand it as best as possible as the people who the original audiences would have understood the Bible. And that takes some study. Yeah. But that's what we should be committed to. is to understand the Bible on our own terms rather than interpreting the Bible in light of the newest ideas. So in Latin America, you know, you have the wedding of Marxist thought with Catholicism. So it's, and in other countries, you have European countries, you have Christian socialism, you have Christianity wedded to certain forms of capitalism and stuff like that. Christianity shouldn't be wedded to anything. It is its own thing. Can it be consistent with capitalism, or can it be consistent with, you know, communism? Those are the questions you have to ask. Rather than building and forming Christianity according to Darwinian thought, or according to Marxist thought, or according to, you know, whoever else's thought, it stands on its own. And how do I judge these other ways of thinking based upon what we understand from Scripture? And so then certain ideas will be compatible, certain ones will not be compatible. Some of them may be indifferent, but that's...
I just see this as the fall of Christianity. I know we're in a post-Christian world, but it's kind of like these places, they're hollowed out as far as Christianity goes, true Christianity, or biblical Christianity. And what's left is, you know, they're...
Well,
that's the whole point. Then what is, you can't even go to a Christian institution anymore.
Yeah,
where do you go?
The only thing I would say, Mark, is that we also have to be careful not to look at Christianity from the perspective of a Western mind. When you look at Christianity from the perspective of the whole globe, Christianity is growing in places where we never would have suspected it's growing. It may be diminishing in the West, but that's not to say that it's not growing at a global level.
I remember once going to a Far East broadcast dinner, and they had a speaker there from some little country over there that up until 1950-some, they had never had a Christian in the country, and now they were just bursting at the seams with churches and that. And he says, it won't be too long down the road until we're sending missionaries to you.
So here, a couple of things I would just sort of add on. We should close here. And that is that and missionaries will tell you about this. When China, under Mao became communist, the country closed to Western missionaries. They got booted out. Decades passed, and nobody knew how these people were doing in their underground churches. 1980s, things begin to open up in China. And all of a sudden, we start to realize there just aren't a few clusters of Christians. There are millions of Christians in China. It thrived under a communist regime. There are things happening all around the world, but the gospel's taken root where we never suspected it ever would have take root. And we may not, there's a lot of stuff we just don't see. And what we do see is very scary, because we know what the West was. We know our own commitments, and we see things happening around us which just is not consistent at all with our faith. But if Christianity could take root in China under Mao, it could do so here too. And just because we're post-Christian does not mean that Christianity is somehow dead, as long as God's at work through His Spirit. And here's the thing. More Christians, we're doing something here, which is what... if this kind of stuff were to catch on and Christians were beginning to really reflect on where they are, where things are at, and begin to approach the situation differently rather than compromising with culture, then you could very well see a rebirth of Christianity. Because what are the answers to the meaning of life that we have been given so far under naturalism? Nothing. There are studies now out on families. If you're a conservative family, you raise your children conservative, those children are going to be far better mentally healthy than far better, far lower suicide rates than if you are raised in a non-Christian, you know, liberal everything goes type environment. Suicide rates of the generations in which we're seeing right now, especially after COVID, are skyrocketing. We're talking multiple times higher than normal. So we live in a generation of nuns, people who have no faith to anything, but that doesn't mean that they don't have some type of sense of spirituality. So it may just take, there may just very well be an opportunity there for the gospel to really hit home and people to rediscover the Christian faith. The thing that bothers me is when Christians get in the way of that happening. That's the thing that bothers me the most. When Christians get in the way of the gospel taking seed in culture.
Yeah. Well,
because they've already given in so much to culture where all they see, you know, they don't see Jesus for who he is in himself. So, and that's, that to me is the more discouraging thing, but I think there's plenty of opportunity. You know, nothing's ever, just remember, Israel was in exile, and God pulled them out of there. Yeah, it only took 70 years for them to do that. You know, Marxism took hold in Russia after the revolution. 70 years later, Russia was no longer called the Soviet Union, it was called Russia again. So God can do all sorts of things through all sorts of individuals to bring culture out of its pits of despair, and that's what we should be praying for.
Well, we've been told we'd be persecuted, and perhaps it's coming to that point that we are, that we need to stand up and speak for Christ. So.
Absolutely. Well, every time is, all the time is the proper time to speak up for Christ. So. Okay. Well, let's just close in prayer. And our Father, we thank you for this time together. Just thank you for the time we've had to reflect on where we are at in society. And we know that nothing is under, because of you, who you are, and because of your ongoing love for your creatures, that, you know, despite how bad things may look right now, that we can thank you, Father, that you are always at work and drawing people to yourself in ways that we don't even understand and comprehend. Just pray now that you'll be with us as we go. Grant us safety in our travels home and throughout the week ahead. In Jesus' name we pray.
Amen.